Macy's, and probably an Neiman Marcus, and maybe a cash equivalent of $10 million, but not the money itself. You can't trust a guy like that with it. I mean, you know, okay, maybe he's not a terrorist, but he's still got a weird name.
Keeping us safe. We have one.
Welcome to the Machine Church on killradio.org. It is Thursday, November 8th, coming up on the end of the year on a hazy, cold day here in Los Angeles, California. Although I guess cold's a relative term if you're living in New York. Nevertheless, I had to wear a jacket this morning. So instead of my usual t-shirt, shorts, and sandals. All right. We're going to kick off today's transmission. We're going to talk a little bit about the dead horse. We're going to talk about Mike Mukasey. but kind of obliquely, we're going to go a little bit backwards. We all know about Mike Mukasey at this point. We all know who he is. We all know that he doesn't think strapping someone to a plank upside down and pouring water over their face so they think they're drowning is torture. And we know that he's sitting on a hot seat trying to get confirmed to be the Attorney General of the United States. Now, a couple broadcasts ago, we talked about how Mike Mukasey was considered a sure thing and that he was a concession from President Bush to the Democrats to give them someone that they would like and that they would want to confirm. And at this point, President Bush is now calling increasingly, and he's doing a lot of drum beating to get the man confirmed. So whether or not that's a political concession, I don't think so at this point, because we've had enough time to look into Mukasey and hear some of his answers about things and kind of get a general idea about what he thinks. So concession, not quite so much, especially since Democrats are turning tail on him, although we had a couple noteworthy senators turn at the last moment from the Judiciary Committee to approve him when what would have been a tied vote actually became a confirmation to send him through to the House. Now, he's in line for a pretty smooth confirmation. He got through the Senate. We're heading him to the House. And the question that that I was thinking about was, you know, why is he there in the first place? I mean, we know about Alberto Gonzalez. We know that name. We know he was the Attorney General for some time. He was pretty transparent in that he didn't really stand out too much until the very end. And I know a lot of people think he got fired. He didn't get fired. He resigned. So I did some research and figured out just exactly what happened and why Mike Mukasey is sitting in the seat he's in the first place, why we're not still under the thumb of Gonzalez in the sense of an attorney general in the Department of Justice. So the first thing that we need to know in the lead-up to the Gonzalez fiasco is that the USA Patriot Act has an interesting little provision in it. And before I go too far, just so everyone out there knows, the full text of the Patriot Act is a gigantic phone book full of doom and gloom, but the title of it is interesting. It doesn't just mean patriot, like you know, tri-corner hats and skip to my loo and macaroni in your ear and things like that. It's actually a funny acronym, like most bills in Congress are these days. The full title of the USA Patriot Act is Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act. So that's what we're talking about. In theory, the Patriot Act is supposed to make America's government better at stopping terrorists from blowing up apple pie. Now, this provision that is the kind of linchpin in the reason that Mukasey is here and Gonzalez is gone is a provision that allows the Attorney General to appoint interim federal attorneys to vacant posts. And that's fine. You know, guys quit, guys get fired, people have to leave. And you've got to fill that spot, and sometimes the confirmation process can be a little long and arduous, depending on how contentious the position is. So that's fine. The president gets to make those appointments as well, obviously, since we're sitting there with Mukasey. So you give the attorney general these powers. Now, the problem is, and the rub is, when the president does that, when he appoints someone as an interim or an acting attorney to a post, that post expires in 120 days from the date that person is installed, unless that person is reviewed and confirmed by the Congress. Now, under the Patriot Act, the appointments that the Attorney General gets to make have no such provisions. Those posts that the Attorney General fills with whoever he likes are permanent, in theory. That person is an acting or interim attorney in the position that he's in, and he gets to sit there forever. So, these provisos under the Patriot Act allow the Attorney General to put whoever he wants into any seat he wants, and that person will stay there permanently. Now, the only obvious drawback and the only obvious caveat to this is the fact that there has to be an empty seat, because if someone's already sitting and they don't plan on going anywhere, those appointments are as long as that person stays there and does their job effectively. So you've got to have an empty seat to appoint someone with this power. And first of all, I'd like to thank the Patriot Act for granting the Attorney General some more unchecked and limitless powers that have absolutely nothing to do with our ability to fight terrorism. Now, from 2005 and 2006, 9 federal attorneys were fired for no real concrete reasons. Most of the reasons that they gave for the firings of these people were that they were underperforming, or their job performance was poor. And in most cases, that actually wasn't true. In one case, an attorney from New Mexico by the name of David Iglesias had a 95% conviction rate. Now, that doesn't sound like someone that I would fire for job performance issues, especially when his job is to get convictions for the government. All 9 of the people who were dismissed were involved in either or both of the following actions. Now, they either made decisions to investigate Republican lawmakers, congressmen, for allegations. You know, the length and breadth of the allegations never, you know, I mean, that information is lost to the wind. But basically, they were involved in decisions that put some heat on the Republicans. Now, they also were involved in decisions that did not investigate allegations of actions by Democrats. In particular, and this is one of the things that was noted, was that they were decided against investigating Democrats for any kind of voter or election fraud, which at this point, with as many things that are going on with election law and how vacuous it is, it's pretty difficult to talk about what election fraud constitutes anymore other than campaigning for yourself within 100 feet of a polling place. You know, Mitt Romney is a multimillionaire, and every month he loans his campaign new money on the order of millions to buy ads in Iowa so that he can win because he have a better chance of winning the primary. And that just goes to show just exactly how flawed our electoral system is, that the guy with the money gets the election because he can buy the advertising time. He gets the 30-second spot that you look at and decide who you want to lead your country based on. I mean, come on. You see a 30-second spot of Mitt Romney talking about how he's going to make everything better, and then leaning back on a couch and holding up his kid, and they're playing and having a great time. He's got his sleeves rolled up and his tie loosened because, you know, he's a hard worker. Of course you like that. Of course you don't like that guy. Anyway, but I digress. Back to Gonzalez. Now, there were 2 firings during that time that were kind of spaced out, and then 7 firings that happened all at once. All at once, just kind of train wrecked right into each other, right at the end of the 2005-2006 period that we're talking about, where these firings took place. Now, in effect, they were fired for doing their jobs, because the concern is, and the reason that all this hubbub started, is that they were fired for not adhering to the administration's political agendas. Now, in doing so, they were definitely doing their jobs, because a federal attorney, once appointed, is intended, supposed to be apolitical. They're supposed to be nonpartisan in their judgments, because they're supposed to be the watchdogs, the people that go out and investigate the crimes of whoever is committing those crimes, regardless of what their political bent is. Now, once you've got that, and then you consider the Patriot Act's provisions allowing the Attorney General to make nominations of whoever he likes, an authority which he further delegated to a couple of underlings in his department, because the great thing about the Patriot Act is that it grants people in their positions authority to do certain things, kind of like the president with the Military Commissions Act, you know, declaring people unlawful enemy combatants at will. He also has the authority to delegate that authority to somebody else or another group. So that's kind of a blanket thing that's happening with Patriot Act powers, is that the person who gets the power also gets to decide who else gets to use that power. So when you consider these things together, the firings become the alleged intent of the firing becomes pretty more clear. It's you can the people that don't agree with you and use the Patriot Act as a shield to put permanent people into positions that are administration friendly, and they don't have to worry about getting confirmed through the Congress, that little roadblock that ensures openness and fairness in our society. So this is also step 7. In the 10 Steps to a Fascist America. Step 7 is target key individuals. I think we've talked about that before. And I know that I've referenced the 10 Steps in previous broadcasts. I've actually got them here today, and I'm going to go through them one by one so that in future broadcasts, when I just throw those references out, people who have listened will actually have an idea about what I'm talking about. Now, Gonzalez resigned amidst all of this flap and all of the stuff that happened. Now, Gonzalez resigned along with the Deputy Attorney General, the Associate Attorney General, the Chiefs of Staff of the Deputy Attorney General and Alberto Gonzalez, the Director of the Executive Office for U.S. Attorneys, and the guy that took his place after the first one resigned, and the Department of Justice's White House liaison. All resigned, all within, all like dominoes falling. And that's jumping ship if I ever saw it. So, you know, we'll never really know what happened. You know, Gonzalez gave hours of testimony in Congress, in hearings about the firings, the reasons for the firings, and there was no, that yielded zero useful information. He did a lot of classic, I don't recall, that was unclear. I would have to investigate that further. So, for someone whose job is to interpret the law, it seems interesting that he can't remember any of it. Nevertheless, you know, we're not going to really know what happened, but it seems pretty obvious. You know, it's the concept of Occam's razor, where the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. And there's no simple explanations in government. I will definitely concede that. On the other hand, you know, you call a spade, and this seems pretty clear what the intent of all this was, given what we know now about the administration and how they've conducted themselves. I mean, you know, there was sworn testimony from Department of Justice officials in Congress that was directly opposed. There was information found in office memoranda and emails during the time period being investigated that directly contradicts the testimony given by the Department of Justice officials. So, you know, that's just more points in the favor of, you know, that little glimmer of, you know, giving somebody a chance, giving them a little benefit of the doubt. You know, that just kind of goes out the window when you consider the lead-up pieces, the reasons for why this happened, and then the fact that it was just flat-out lied about or completely unreferenced in the case of Gonzalez, not really knowing what was going on. That's basically what happened. That's the reason Alberto Gonzalez is gone, the reason he resigned, and also the reason that Mike Mukasey is now fielding questions about waterboarding, much to the Democrats' dislike of his answers and inability to block him, because he's going to get through. I've said it before, and I'll say it again now. Mike Mukasey is going to be confirmed to the Attorney General post in the Department of Justice, and yeah, unfortunately, business will continue along as usual. And we've got a little bit of a glimmer of hope, because if Giuliani doesn't get the election, which he's leading the polls pretty handily right now, along with Hillary, so we're still looking at a Hillary versus Giuliani 2008. Hopefully, that won't be the case. If there's any sparkle of hope and goodness left in the galaxy, that won't be the choice for the American people next year. But if Giuliani gets elected to the presidency, if he makes the Republican nomination and gets elected to the White House, then Mike Mukasey will stay, because those guys are all buddies, and you don't fire your buddy. So, especially when he supported you through your tenure as a public official. If Hillary gets in there, who knows? You know, she's got some pretty mixed loyalties and some pretty unsure views, apparently. So she might just go in there and figure, hey, he's been doing the job, we'll just let him stay, because his powers to do what he wants are complementary to my own. Because when Hillary goes into the White House, if she makes it, she will have significantly more power as an executive than her husband did when Bill was in office. She's sworn in interviews that she would begin immediately to scale back that power and give it back to the Congress and to the various branches of government where it should be. But I don't know. I find that a little hard to believe. All right. You are listening to The Machine Church on killradio.org. When we get back, we're going to be talking about Israel versus Hezbollah, This is edition 3, the team-up edition, and we're going to be talking a little bit about Pakistan and some more end-of-the-world goodness, and once we get back, we will dig into all of that, so stay tuned.
Go now, you can set free another month or so.
You know, I gotta say, I love tracks from the 80s because they always fade themselves out. I don't have to worry about sliding the slider down on the mixer. All right. Now, we are back on the Machine Church. You are listening to killradio.org. And we're going to be talking a little bit about some things from the End of the World department here on the church. A report from a couple of days ago was talking about a gear up on both sides of the fence between Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Israeli military. Now, recently, the Israeli military released a statement that they believe now that Hezbollah has rocket capability to deliver payloads right into Tel Aviv from their locations around the Lebanese border and slightly inside Israel. Whether or not that's the case, I don't know. I don't know of Hezbollah getting a whole lot of extra funding from various groups in the aftermath of the last war, though they fired off a lot of their ordnance and did take some lumps, even though they ended up winning last year. So I don't know. Did Hezbollah get more effective rockets in the last 12 months? That may be the case, and if so, then good for them. Nevertheless, there is a buildup going on both sides, and this harkens back to last year. Last year, there was a war between Israel and Lebanon that lasted for about a month. I believe it took about a month for everything to draw itself to a relatively full conclusion. Now, the war at that point in time was over a couple of Israeli soldiers that got taken. Whether or not that was the case remains to be seen, as I have taken to saying so frequently. It lasted 34 days. Israel mobilized one of the most modern militaries in the world, financed almost entirely by the United States government with our technology mixed with their own, and they sent it into Lebanon, which is that's the short bus key to the Middle East when it comes down to it, to go up against Hezbollah guerrillas that were trenched in the lower portion of the southern Lebanon, south of Beirut, etc. And it was basically a test to see how a modernized military could handle an entrenched guerrilla force fighting from terrain that they were familiar with. There was indigenous terrain. And Israel lost really badly, exceptionally badly, catastrophically badly. The word on it was that the results of the war were inconclusive because they battered each other for a little bit. Israel didn't inflict a whole lot of casualties on Hezbollah. And Hezbollah, in return, didn't do much to the Israeli military because it is one of the most modern militaries in the world. But Israel couldn't get a foothold. And as is the course of action in wars in the Middle East that don't involve the U.S., if they can't get in there and get the job done within a short amount of time, there's generally a pullback and a regroup. So obviously when the U.S. goes in, we jump in with both feet and stay there forever. But saying the war was inconclusive, from a military point of view, they may have been correct because not a whole lot of ordnance was destroyed or equipment or, the forces weren't battered too terribly. But from a geopolitical standpoint, it was very conclusive because Israel lost and then consequently lost its threat of deterrence. One of the reasons that Israel has not been steamrolled by all the Muslim nations that surround it and hate it is because it has this military. It has this policy of nuclear ambiguity, so no one really knows if they have weapons, even though it's assumed that they do, nuclear weapons. So there's always this threat that, if you go in after Israel, you're gonna get fucked. They're gonna blow you the hell away. And last year's war showed that they, while they have the capability to do so, they may not have the tactics, or they may not have the strategy, or they may not have the wherewithal to actually follow through with it because they didn't. Now, there was a phone call between an Israeli official and an unnamed respondent in Cheney's office last year before the war that basically amounted to a couple of kids deciding on whether or not they were going to go tag up a building. Should we go in? Yes, you should go in. We've only got two more years where we can back you up. If you go in now, we can back you up. And this is, back and forth between the American and the Israeli. And so when you think about it in that context, and when you look at it in the larger view that it was basically a smaller analog of what it would be like if the U.S. attacked Iran, because Israel has basically the American military in a small, compact little package, and Hezbollah is basically the resistance that we'd encounter in Iran because they are moderately well-trained but extremely zealous and fanatical guerrillas, insurgent types that would be counteracting us on familiar territory to them. When you look at it in that point of view, it's pretty easy to see that it was a little dry run, I guess you'd say. It was the dress rehearsal. I think that if Israel had won the war, if Israel had gone in, ramshackled their way through Hezbollah, thrown out a couple sonic booms and Hadoukens and taken out the guerrillas and rolled into Lebanon, I think that we would already be in war. We'd already be engaged in a war in Iran, because that would have been the green light for the U.S. contingent that wants to go in and subjugate the entire Middle East. I think that would have been all the proof they needed that we could do it, and we'd be in there already. So in that sense, I'm actually pretty thankful that Hezbollah is out there lobbing rockets. And that's not to say that I'm happy about people getting blown up, but I'm also happy that the U.S. military isn't trying to go somewhere that to go into further quagmire. So it may not matter in the long run, because we've only got about a year left in Bush's reign over the empirical states of the United States. And if he has his way, I think we will get stuck into Iran. I think there will be some action with Iran before he leaves, and it doesn't matter who gets up there. Hillary, Giuliani, you know, fucking Ralph Nader could get elected by miracle to the presidency, and he would have to deal with conducting military action in Iran. He wouldn't, you know, you can't jump into that pool and then just jump right back out again. That's a pretty deep stagnant quagmire pool to jump into, and I think Bush is going to do his damnedest to push America off the edge of the pool into the deep end before he bails out back to Texas and sits on his oil money. So, you know, it may be a non-issue that Israel lost, but we've got another conflict brewing. And I say that with a bit of an asterisk, because there's always conflict brewing in the Middle East. You know, they made a computer game about it in the 80s, like I was talking about last week. But this time around, you know, when it gets down to crunch time, we're running low on time for Bush to back things up. I think Israel will give it another shot. And you know, we would want Israel to go back in against Hezbollah and win, especially if we want to go into Iran. And when I say we, I don't mean me or anyone listening or anything like that. I mean we, the United States government, the people that are making the policy. They want to get into Iran. They want to do it before Bush leaves to make it something that we have to stick with. And it makes sense that we'd want Israel to go back in against Hezbollah so that we can see round two. Israel learned some lessons against Hezbollah. They battered them a little bit, got an idea about the scenery. And now if they go back in, we'll learn some new lessons, and we'll get to watch it, and we'll get to sideline, you know, stay on the kind of sidelines and see how it worked and take notes, and then turn around and transfer those notes into posties to go inside of our tanks and planes and send those over into Iran. And in this case, the U.S. is obliquely supporting both sides. Now, it's clear that the U.S. is connected to Israel. I guess the term would be in bed with, because we give Israel a lot of aid. We're very connected with them on an intelligence level and a military level, especially considering the circumstances of the region. They're a strong ally, some like to say. So yes, we support Israel. Now, we also support the Lebanese government. And the rub on that is the Hezbollah faction has a large contingent of representation in the Lebanese government. Now, they may not have a democratic majority like we have in our Congress. They may not have a strong voice, but they have a presence nevertheless, so they have some influence over where money goes, because the U.S. gives aid to the Lebanese government. So, you know, to think that some of that money doesn't get funneled off to the actual, from the Hezbollah in suits and nice ties that sit in Beirut in the halls of the government. If you think that some of that money that we give to Lebanon, the Lebanese government, doesn't get siphoned off to the guys in masks with rockets out in the dunes, I don't know what to say about that. So those guys are getting money too. We're basically funding both sides of a war, and that makes perfect sense. Because if we want Israel to go in to fight Hezbollah and win so that we can see how they won, so that we can transfer that into our military and take it into Iran when we leave Iraq in the dust, just like we left Afghanistan in the dust, to go fight a third war, we want the opposition to that Israeli example of warfare to be solid. Because if you think about what's going to happen if we go into Iran, chances are Russia's going to give some backing to Iran, because those guys are big economic partners. You know, Russia's talking about helping Iran build civilian nuclear power plants. You know, they're in bed when it comes to oil, things like that. You know, Vladimir Putin and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad just had a big summit very recently with lots of smiles and handshakes all around. And of course, you know, world leaders don't like to get photographed when they're not smiling and shaking hands. But regardless, you know, we don't know the content of that meeting, whether it was good, bad, ugly. We don't know, so we can't say. And the fact that they had it, and the fact that someone was willing to go down to meet with the leader, well, the president of Iran. Since, again, the president of Iran doesn't lead the country, the supreme leaders and the Muslim clerical council do. You know, the fact that Putin is willing to go down there and have this meeting and smile and handshake makes you wonder. So whether or not we know what was in the meeting, we know there's probably going to be there's some connection somehow. So the assumption has to be made that if Iran gets into some military difficulties, Russia's probably going to send some support. So you've got Israel as a proxy for the U.S. and Hezbollah, indirectly backed by the U.S. through our aid to the Lebanese government, as a proxy for Iran, backed by Russia. And you know, it makes sense, because if you want to be a boxer, you don't go to the gym and spar against newbies. You go up against real deal Holyfields, and that's the only way to figure out if you can really compete. So, you know, Israel is very concerned about a nuclear armed Iran, because they know that Iran hates them, and made all the more clear by the president of Iran saying that Israel should be wiped off the map. And now, you know, say what you will about Israel, say what you will about Iran and their policies and their connection to each other, and say what you will about the president of Iran, you know, world leaders just shouldn't talk like that. That's not something you want your elected officials to be talking about, wiping a country off the face of the planet. And whether or not, you know, like I said, say what you will about Israel, but, you know, wiping things off the face of the planet, at least, you know, you can have whatever beliefs you want, but if you're the president of a country, you should probably keep those beliefs under your hat, or at least amongst close circles, not part of press conferences that get broadcast around the world. Nevertheless, Israel's been pushing for strikes against Iran since before we went into Iraq. You know, they tried to use last year's war as a show that the U.S. could go in there and do some damage against Iran, but they didn't quite make it. But they're getting ready to roll back in, and they're hoping that this time they'll show us that the job can get taken care of quickly, and give us the green light to get in there. You know, if Iran is the big bully picking on Israel, which my personal view isn't the case, but if that is the case, if Iran's the big bully picking on Israel, it's a lot easier for Israel to, you know, clock the short kid, clock Lebanon around the back of the head and send them sprawling, and then point to him, and then point to the U.S. and say, "See, we did it. You can too. And once you go take out that bruiser over there, two countries over." You know, the U.S. has no viable interest in a war with Iran. They don't have any strategic resources for us. They're not in any kind of line to make them you know, geographically significant. I mean, if you wanted to stretch the imagination, You could envision a pipeline from the Caspian Sea region through Afghanistan, Iraq, and then through Iran into India, which is an ally of the U.S. And you know, that would be a way to get oil out. But you know, we're allies with Turkey. We're allies with Saudi Arabia to a certain and strange degree. And we've already got Iraq and Afghanistan, so it seems silly to have to go start a war with another country just so we can run some pipes through it. But I wouldn't put it past our administration, because it doesn't seem like they have their heads on straight in the first place. You know, going into Iran, the only rhetoric that could support going into Iran with military action would be that we got to stamp out those terrorists. We got to protect. We got to subjugate the threat to the homeland. We've got to make it so that Iran can't spawn terrorist groups to come in and try to take us out. Now, this is a set of statistics, and this is from the most recent issue of Adbusters magazine, which if you don't read, I recommend it. It's refreshing to read a magazine that's all content and zero advertising. But this is the estimated number of American deaths from 2001 to 2005. And top of the list is heart disease. And this is excluding smoking-related cases of heart disease. And that's 3.1 million. 3,119,142 deaths to heart disease, not including smoking-related cases. Now, 2.6 million are smoking-related. That's 2,652,000. You've got 2.3 million dying of cancer, and that's excluding smoking-related cancers. And then trailing distantly, 436,890 die of diabetes. And I'm sure that has a bit of a hand to go with the heart disease and the hamburger that you're eating. 228,000 are estimated to have died of secondhand smoke. 180,000 have died from suicide. So, you know, when you consider the fact that happiness levels in America are the lowest they've been since we started polling how happy people are. You know, that makes some sense that suicide beats out drunk driving deaths by about 70,000 or 80,000. 102,000 people died of drunk driving in that time period, that four-year time period. 96,000 people died of homicide. So we're not even killing each other more than we're killing each other with hamburgers and nooses and cigarettes, apparently. And then in the very, very far distant fractional bottom of the list is terrorism. And the number of American deaths from 2001 to 2005 by terrorism estimated numbers at 3,000. So when you consider that in the light of what we're doing to ourselves and the way we're living our lives, terrorism just doesn't seem like that big of a threat to send us in to Iran to start more permanent war. You know, like, it makes zero sense. It makes zero sense, and it fucking pisses me off that we keep talking about this. We keep talking about how we want, you know, diplomatic solutions against Iran or to keep them from getting nuclear weapons are the point, but not ruling out military action. It's like, what are you talking about? That makes zero sense. It has no connection to reality. But I've given up on that with our government. It doesn't seem like they have much connection to reality as it is these days. So there you have it. 3,000 died from terrorism, and that's going to be, I promise, that's going to be the reason why we go in to attack Iran within the next year, because they're going to get a bomb. And you know, we can't let the state that sponsors terrorism to get a nuclear bomb, and that's going to be the reason. And I'll tell you what else: it's going to start with airstrikes, because everything else has started with airstrikes. Once you wake up in the morning and read the news, or watch the evening news, or whenever time it happens, you know, once you see U.S. airstrikes on Iran, that's the end of the world. That's what that's the end of the United States as we know it. More than anything else that's happened, more than the Patriot Act, more than the rolling back of civil liberties, more than the watering down and neutering of the government, you know, America going to war against Iran is the end of America as we know it. The history books have this notion of America, and that notion will be dashed if we go in against Iran. And furthermore, the world could possibly end up being dashed if we go in against Iran, because a confrontation between the U.S. and Iran could quickly turn into a confrontation against the U.S. and Iran allied with Russia. And the U.S. and Israel lobbing nukes at Iran and Russia just doesn't end. That just ends poorly for everybody. And what are we going to do about it? What can we as Americans do to stop our country from inciting the end of our country as we know it? Unfortunately, not a whole lot. You know, Christmas is coming up, and man, we got to start buying presents. Can't wait. Thank God for Christmas to take our minds off of things. You know, we're inching toward expanded war. The Congress is about to go on their seasonal break, and therefore they will not be present to have any say in what the president decides to do with any of his executive privilege or his executive actions while he's they're out celebrating their various holidays. You know, and our economy is teetering on the brink of collapse. But I hope I get that iPod for Christmas. All right. Gloom and doom from the end of the world desk. You know, we've also got things like you know, what's going on in Pakistan with Musharraf suspending basically all. I mean, whatever the news report has been to this point, you know, at this point in Pakistan, you know, democratic law is suspended. You know, a couple of days ago they had 3,500 lawyers, legal professionals, demonstrating in the streets trying to get the laws of the country reenacted, and 3,500 of them were arrested for their, you know, when does a lawyer get arrested in America unless, you know, you find out that he was, you know, sleeping with the secretary or embezzling money? You know, our lawyers don't get arrested for protesting against anything, but 3,500 legal professionals arrested in Pakistan for protesting Musharraf's pretty obvious grab for power. You know, and it's amazing the concessions we're willing to give this guy. You know, it's been 5 or 6 days now. You know, they've suspended the rule of law. They've suspended the democratic process. Musharraf, who conveniently enough is also the general of the army and the army's chief of staff, as well as being the president of the country, has put on the iron glove and clenched his fist. And, you know, Bhutto, who is his direct competition, any rallies in her favor, any rallies that she puts on, will have been threatened to be shut down by the military. So there's no you're silencing all voices of consent or dissent. Pardon me. So you know all this is going on, and the most that we've done from the United States point of view, other than kind of shake our heads and cross our arms, is that we have applauded, as of today, issued a statement in favor of the President General Musharraf's decision to proceed with elections as of next February. And that leaves Pakistan in a state of flux. Well, I guess you wouldn't call it flux, considering it's being locked down. But it leaves their government in a state of flux and uncertainty for another 2.5 months, if not longer. And that gives him plenty of time to consolidate all the power he wants while he's there. And we're applauding his decision to hold elections in February. They were supposed to be in January. What's another month? What's another 3 weeks for elections when, you know, you've got this situation that needs to be reconciled now? You know, and you've got Senator Joseph Biden from Delaware. You know, he's a Democrat from Delaware. He calls Musharraf on the phone and tells him to take off the uniform and be the president. Restore the rule of law to his country. All right, talk to you later. Bye. Click. I'm sure that's going to do a whole lot of good, Joe. You know, it's kind of scary that President Bush and Pervez Musharraf are having conversations even at this point, especially when you consider that Pakistan for its lumps was considered a pretty good democracy, And within the space of 5 days, it has been completely annihilated and possibly beyond the hope of return. And no one's taking any action. The UN isn't doing anything. The US isn't doing anything. Regional partners aren't doing anything. I'm sure India is just wringing their hands in glee that their biggest opponent is in such a state of turmoil. But no one's doing anything about it. You've got a healthy, vibrant democracy that just got basically overturned. And President General Musharraf is now, who knows, I mean, president for life. Call it what it is. Why don't you call him what he wants to be? You know, the same thing's happening in Venezuela with Hugo Chavez, who I was a fan of around the time of the UN General Assembly in the last year when, you know, he was very critical of Bush and wasn't afraid to do so. There's a lot of reasons why Chavez and Bush don't like each other, and that's a topic to go into at a different time. But nevertheless, he's very critical of President Bush, very critical of American policies overseas, American policies on oil. And that kind of earned him some endearment from myself and some people that I know, some people that are kind of on the same wavelength as I am. But now it's pretty clear that he's doing the same thing. He's not doing it quite as quickly and cleanly and obviously as Musharraf, but he's been consolidating power ever since. And, you know, when he says stuff like Venezuela has the most healthy democracy in the world, you kind of look at his the policies that he's enacted and you think maybe not quite so much. So, you know, we're witnessing the downfall of democracy across the world. You've got China, which is a vaguely communist nation still, you know, regardless of whatever policies they may have enacted since driving over people with tanks to consolidate power. You know, that nation's on the rise. It's one of the rising stars economically. You know, they own the United States in the sense that they own our economy and have a death grip on whether or not the dollar survives. You've got, you know, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, one of the biggest oil producing states in South America, slowly consolidating power. Pervez Musharraf has taken over in Pakistan, and our own democracy is bleeding from the gums at this point with the things that have been going on. Gloom and doom. All right. We are going to take a break. You are listening to The Machine Church on killradio.org. When we get back, we are going to be talking about the 10 steps to a fascist America. And once we're done with that, we're going to talk a little bit about the Congress, the water bill that got passed, vetoed, and then overturned, that was a little bit of a smack in the face to Bush, although it probably doesn't mean a whole lot. We'll talk a little bit about some elections, and then we'll be out. But right now we're taking a break. Machine Church on killradio.org. Stay tuned. La 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 la
city tonight. We'll see the city's ripped back sides. We'll see the bright and hollow sky. We'll see the stars that shine so bright. A stars made for us tonight. How he rides. Oh, the passenger. And he rides and he rides. He looks through his window. What does he see? He sees a sight and hollow sky. He sees the stars come out tonight. He sees the city's ripped back sides. He sees the winding ocean drive. And everything was made for you and me. All of it was made for you and me. But it just belongs to you and me. So let's take a ride and see what's mine. Glass. He looks through his window inside. He sees the things he knows are his. He sees the bright and hollow sky. He sees the city asleep at night. He sees the stars are out tonight. And all of it is yours and mine. And all of it is yours and mine. So let's ride and ride and ride.
Yet again, auto fade out. Thanks, Iggy. All right. Now we're going to talk about the 10 steps to a fascist America. In April of this year, a columnist named Naomi Wolf wrote an essay basically detailing these 10 steps and the 10 things that you would do, you know, to create a fascist state in any circumstance. Obviously, it was used in reference to America because that's where we're going and that's where we're heading and that's what all the signs point to. You know, she started off by talking about how the coup last year in Thailand was a perfect coup. And it was. Last year in Thailand, the prime minister of that nation left to attend the UN General Assembly. And in his absence, Sagat stole his country. You know, M. Bison left to fight Khan in New York. And Sagat stole his country while he was gone. Because the general of the military, the commander of the Thai military... executed probably one of the best coups in history. Tanks rolled the streets. They targeted the communications locations first. Communication locations. All right, we're not in Schoolhouse Rock. But anyway, the communication hubs, you know, the news outlets, all those kinds of things, the houses of government, the houses of parliament officials were all locked down, and the military took control, and the Thai PM hasn't even returned to that country. You know, and there was, you know, say what you will about, you know, the Thai PM's politics. You know, they weren't very clear. I didn't get a whole lot about them. He was somewhat Bush-like in a lot of respects from what I gleaned from it. You know, that's that information is kind of lost to history at this point. It's over a year and a half old now. But I'm sure you could dig it up if you wanted to find it. But nevertheless, the basics of it is that, you know, the PM of Thailand at that time, the prime minister, was somewhere along the lines of a President Bush type figure for that nation. So, you know, whether or not a coup was a good thing in effect that got rid of him, if that was the case. But nevertheless, it did take an open democracy, for as flawed as it may have been, and turn it into a dictatorship. And overnight, I mean, we're talking overnight. The next morning, after the night of the coup, when everyone was asleep, the next morning, you know, people didn't know, or they knew but didn't care. You know, it was like traffic on the 405. Just like every other morning, people get up, go to work. Oh, he's in control now? Meh, whatever. I mean, that's basically what happened here. If Cheney cooed Bush and took over and all of a sudden was in power, you'd still get up and go to work in the morning. You'd bitch the whole way. And there'd probably be some people that would be outraged, totally furious, but they'd still get up and go to work in the morning. All right. So that was the preface to this, these 10 steps to a fascist America, talking about the coup in Thailand and how easy and beautiful it was. You know, and now we've got even more. We've got, Chavez in Venezuela taking control a little bit more thoroughly. We've got Musharraf taking control pretty damn completely. And we've got 10 steps to a fascist America. Now, step one is pretty obvious and pretty clear. And once I say it, we'll all know exactly what we're talking about. Step one is to invoke a terrifying internal and external enemy. And again, that should go without saying. What's more terrifying than a fucking terrorist? They're coming to America and they want to blow us the hell up. Our own hearts giving out is more of a threat to an American citizen than a terrorist. But it's very, very easy to invoke this enemy. And that's why the war on terror is such a big deal. That's why everything we do is to protect the homeland, defend America from terrorists, stop Iran from becoming a terror sponsor, you know. Invoke a terrifying enemy. Okay, well, that enemy is terror. So we're terrified of terror. You know, that's pretty goddamn easy. And, you know, if you want an example of another vague war on that hasn't yielded any results, go look at the war on drugs. You know, David Cross once cracked a joke that declaring a war on terror is like declaring a war on jealousy, and that's the fucking truth. Because what are you going to do? You can't win. We can't win the war on drugs. We can't win the war on terror. Terrified of terror. Like, that's permanent forever. Of course we're terrified of terror. It's terrifying. All right. So, I mean, that one's obvious, and it's already been done, and it's already a firmly entrenched and intractable part of American society. Every American who lives in America today is aware of the threat of terrorists and the threat of terror and terror-sponsoring nations. So, step one, achieved. Step two is to create a gulag. And those of you that know anything about Soviet history know the gulags were the jails that you got sent to, and if you got sent to a gulag, you weren't coming back. Now, Halliburton's already doing that, or at least they're ready to. You know, this is a couple of years ago that a Halliburton subsidiary by the name of Kellogg, Brown, and Root was awarded a $385 million contract by the Department of Homeland Security to, in the event of a national emergency, construct detention and processing facilities on the U.S. soil. So you've got a non-government contractor building jails that have nothing to do with the state to detain and process people, and whatever all that means. So, you know, we haven't created the gulags, at least not that we're aware of yet. I'm sure that there's been some groundbreaking and some foundation laying, but the money's out there. It's been approved to Halliburton subsidiaries, no less. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised about that, but there it is. The money's out there to build jails for you and me, because if we have anything negative to say about Uncle Sam once he takes his red, white, and blue hat off and replaces it with a Castro-style military cap, then we're probably going to go to one of those jails. And even if you don't have anything bad to say, there's a very good chance you might end up there anyway. And we'll get to that in a minute. You know, you've got someone like Senator Lindsey Graham who encouraged Alberto Gonzalez during his time as Attorney General to target, quote, fifth columnists. and a fifth columnist, apparently. I wasn't aware of this term until I read this article, or this essay. But apparently a fifth columnist is an American who shows disloyalty and sympathizes with the enemy. So I guess that makes me firmly a fifth columnist, because just earlier in this broadcast, as sirens go by and British-style horns honk, well, that's a lot of them. Just earlier in this broadcast, I talked about how I was thankful that Hezbollah beat Israel so that we weren't already in war with Iran. So I guess that makes me a fifth columnist, whatever that term means. Hopefully I'm not also a unlawful enemy combatant at some point. All right. And as an interesting aside, through KBR, Kellogg, Brown and Root, Halliburton was involved in the building of all the detention centers in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Kellogg, Brown and Root were embroiled at the time in a human sex slave trade that their representatives had lobbied to continue. So we've got companies building prisons in nations that we've conquered using sex slave labor to do so, and they have a contract to build those same facilities right here in the U.S. And I don't know, maybe they'll round up all the hookers off the streets to build them for us. You know, when I first read this, this is one of the things that makes you speechless. You know, companies who are against laws barring the trade of human sex slaves get contracts to build civilian detention centers on U.S. soil. Now, the list of people who we rounded up, the list of quote-unquote fifth columnists, you know, as of last year, that had about 350 names on it, and God knows how many it has now. Step 3 in the fascist America, the 10 steps to a fascist America, is to develop a thug cast. And this is a cast of people that are kind of the mindless enforcers. Now, when you consider the fact that Blackwater has been operating autonomously in Iraq as security private security contractors that are not affiliated with the U.S. military, only loosely, we've already been doing that. You know, Blackwater's not culpable for anything they do out there. And, you know, they've been a little overzealous, and they've made some mistakes that are a little too high profile to ignore. So you've got a situation where you can't just sweep it under the rug. And things have been, Congress has actually made motions to try to get things worked on a little bit. But whether or not those motions get followed through on in the time it takes to go to Christmas break and come back and have the media hubbub die down about Blackwater, you know, we'll see if anything actually happens. But Blackwater's in Iraq. Why can't they be here in the U.S.? What would stop them from being private security contractors for the United States government right here in the United States, especially if we end up in a state of a national emergency, because our military is stretched thin with that war in Iran, America. So don't mind this handy mercenary in blue blocker sunglasses, you know, standing out front of your front door to make sure that terrorists can't get to you. You know, we're all getting used to the idea of National Guardsmen, like uniformed personnel with guns patrolling the American streets. After Katrina, National Guard was sent there. You know, they've talked about sending National Guard to handle things in the wildfires. But basically, we're kind of used to that image now. If it happened tomorrow, if there was a justifiable reason, especially if it had something to do with terror, we'd be terrified enough to shrug our shoulders and say, okay, well, I'm glad that guy in a uniform with a machine gun is patrolling my quaint little small bread, white bread town, USA, you know, is patrolling, you know, Whistling Oak Avenue. We're going to be okay with that because we're used to it. We've seen it. We've seen the National Guard walking around patrolling American streets. And that is so bad, there's a law against it. There is a law called Posse Comitatus. And basically, it bars barring extreme circumstances, that law prohibits the military or any paramilitary organization from patrolling or policing American streets, because the whole point, and this is more points to the founding fathers having more heads on their shoulders than, or more brains in their heads, I guess you'd say, than people want to give them credit for. You know, a police officer, as much as you might hate the pigs, or whatever you want to say about it, a police officer who was born in the area, grew up in the area, gets a job as a cop to patrol the streets, He knows the lay of the land. He knows the kind of people that live there. You know, it's like we elect representatives from our districts to go and represent us. And that concept is broken down to a certain degree. But regardless, the theory is the same. You know, you've got a police officer that has some personal investment in the community that he's policing. And that's intended and to be enforced by law, except barring extreme circumstances. You know, a National Guardsman from Georgia who's patrolling streets in South Central L.A. has zero interest in the community. He has zero interest in, you know, he has no investiture in the community that he's now patrolling with a locked and loaded rock and roll machine gun. He's following orders. And whoever gave him those orders is the one that's in control of him. So, you know, we haven't necessarily developed a Thugcast. Blackwater is as close as you can get. We've got private contractors out there that are kind of building up our immunity to the concept of it. And we've got some things that have happened in recent history that are, again, building up our immunity to it. So the Thugcast is being developed in concept, if not actually in reality and physicality. So that's one step that's done for sure, and two steps that are ready to roll whenever the time comes right. And sirens. All right. Step 4 in the 10 steps to a fascist America is to set up an internal surveillance system. And this is a step that is definitely 100% on the money, for sure, complete. You know, with the Protect America Act expanding the powers of the National Security Agency to wiretap individuals basically at will with minor and the only checks on that are on paper in reality, because when you say that the only check is that you have to have reasonable belief that the individual that you're targeting is outside the United States, and that's it, and like there's no checks on what the content of the conversation is believed to be, there's no checks on who they can be talking to. The target, the primary target, has to be reasonably believed to be outside the United States, and that's it. And if that one very mercurial requirement is met, then you can tap somebody's phone. And you know, one of the provisions about the expansion and permanency of this act that's being talked about right now in our Congress is to make the phone companies, the domestic United States phone companies that are culpable in providing phone tapping and wiretapping information and providing the actual wiretapping itself, make them immune from now on and retroactively to any legal action against them for what they've done. So you can wiretap anybody you want for free, and they can't do anything about it. Because, hey, man, you were reasonably believed to be outside the United States. Man, I was in Jersey. Fucking whatever. This is something that is done. It's already in the books. And President Bush is working hard to make sure that it gets made permanent. It was a one-year proviso to extend the Freedom of American Act, the Foreign Intelligence Services Act, or Security Act. And they want to make it permanent and expand it. So this is something that's already there. It's ready to roll. It's done. Step 4 is complete. Now, step 5 in the 10 steps is to harass citizens groups. And Naomi Wolf, the author of this article, said it the best, so I'm just going to read right out of hers. The American Civil Liberties Union reports that thousands of ordinary American anti-war, environmental, and other groups have been infiltrated by agents. A secret Pentagon database includes more than 4 dozen peaceful anti-war meetings, rallies and marches by American citizens in its category of 1,500 suspicious incidents. The equally secret Counterintelligence Field Activity Agency of the Department of Defense has been gathering information about domestic organizations engaged in peaceful political activities. CIFA is supposed to track, quote, potential terrorist threats as it watches ordinary U.S. citizen activities. A little noticed new law has redefined activism such as animal rights protests as terrorism. So the definition of terrorist slowly expands to include the opposition, and this is so much the case, it's not even a question. You know, this is all 1960s McCarthyism Redux. You know, when students' groups were being infiltrated by government officials to make sure they weren't commies. Only now it's not commies we're worried about, it's terrorists. But it doesn't matter who we're worried about or what word we want to put on it. It's a terrifying internal and external enemy that can't be fought or markedly opposed. So, you know, the new McCarthyism, the terrorism threat. And so if you've ever gone to a protest or been to a rally or, you know, spoken out in favor of the Constitution or even something as simple as animal rights, you just might be a potential terrorist threat. In which case, I wouldn't be surprised if you ended up as an unlawful enemy combatant at some point in the not-so-distant future. So, step five, check. So, as of step five, halfway through the 10 steps, we've got 3 steps that are checked off and 2 steps that are just ready to, there's a pen hovering over the empty checkbox just waiting to make that mark. Step 6 in the 10 steps to a fascist America is to engage in arbitrary detention and release. And I was talking about this with a friend of mine who listens to the show, who's a lawyer. And the instant I read this, he rolled his eyes and said, oh, well, they're doing that. You know, you go to the airport and somebody, you know, 4 or 5 people at random get picked. And they have to go into a room and sit and have their luggage gone through and to make sure there's no terrorist threats on the plane. There you go. There's your arbitrary detention and release. And because God knows we don't want terrorists blowing up planes, we submit to it, and we get used to it, and our resistance to it beefs up, and then we get pretty comfortable with that concept. We get okay with it. So, step 6, check. The next step is step 7. And we've talked about that. We talked about this today. I mentioned it in the previous program. And step 7 is target key individuals. So we've built, we've got gulags ready to get built. We've got citizens groups that have been harassed. We're already culpable and comfortable with engaging in being arbitrarily detained and released. And just to go back to that for one moment, you know, when I was a kid, I used to go on fishing trips with my dad. And we would fly to a little city in Mexico, in Baja California, on the inside of the Sea of Cortez called Laredo. And it's got a lot of history. It's got the first mission that was ever built in the Americas and stuff like that. But the airport's this little building with a little straw roof. And you go inside and you wait in a room. And, you know, everyone's sitting there with their bags. And you walk up with your bags. And there's a big, giant, like, modified street light. And the guard, the AK-47 armed, like uniform wearing guard at this airport terminal, presses a button, and at random, the stoplight that you're standing in front of either flashes green and says passe, or it flashes red and says no passe. It's completely at random, and if you get a green passe, go on, have fun, have a good time. They won't even look in your bags. If you get a red no passe, then they will take out razor blades, carve open every orifice of every bag you've got, everything you've brought in, pull out every bit of your clothing and all of your things, and just siphon through every part of it. And that's what's happening at American airports now. I used to chuckle about it as, you know, a 12-year-old kid flying to Mexico going, good Christ, how fucking backward is this? And you know what? Now it's happening at LAX. Not only that, but in addition to all that, the screeners at LAX roundly failed random testing by the security watchdogs looking into how good the airports are doing on their policy of increasing security. LAX failed. San Francisco failed too by a smaller margin, but regardless, they did not catch in most cases items that were clearly bomb-like, you know. And I don't know how easy it was. I don't know how easy they made it to see it. You know, I'm sure it wasn't like a bundle of dynamite with an alarm clock stuck to it. But you know, with airport screeners that are supposed to go to training, you know, monthly, weekly, whatever, to see all the new things, all the new possible threats, the fact that they miss them, you know, in LAX they miss them 8 times out of 10. It's reassuring. But hey, man, if you get picked at random, they're going to go through every part of your bag. Hopefully they won't find your stash. All right, so moving back up to step 7, target key individuals. Now, when the Soviet Union took power and conglomerated all the neighboring states, when Russia took power and conglomerated all the neighboring states into the Soviet Union, there was a concept called the Black Vans. And a buddy of mine's family grew up in Ukraine at this time, and his dad used to talk about it. And the Black Vans, basically, they would roll up, the doors would open, and someone would disappear. And, it was clergy, professors, noteworthy individuals that spoke out against the communist consolidation of power. They disappeared. You'd see them on the sidewalk one moment, the van would roll up in front of them, obscure them from your view, the van would jostle a little bit and take off, and they'd be gone. And that was it, because they got sent to those gulags in Siberia. And now that sucks. Because, I mean, I'm sure gulags in America will be built, like, in the Midwest somewhere where there's plenty of space, like in the middle of Colorado or something like that. Or, Nebraska, where there's plenty of open, flat, open ground that you can't escape from. But, man, a Siberian gulag that's got to suck. I mean, I can't deal with it when it's 62 degrees and I got to wear, socks and put two extra blankets on the bed because I'm so cold. I wouldn't be able to handle that gulag in Siberia. But targeting key individuals, man. You know, when you've got a guy like Alberto Gonzalez firing, federal attorneys to use his expanded powers to install people that he would rather have that are more administration friendly, that's targeting key individuals. You know, they haven't done it on a civilian level yet, to any degree that we're aware of as Americans. But it's there. The law is there. The legality is available. I mean, Military Commissions Act of 2006, man. The president has the authority to declare anyone he wishes, American citizens included, an unlawful enemy combatant. And once you have that moniker, you are therefore eligible to be held and detained arbitrarily for any amount of time they desire in those gulags that Halliburton built with sex slave labor. So, just keep a lookout. Because when it starts happening here in America, something tells me we're probably just going to roll over and let it happen, which is even more frightening than anything else. Step 8 on the 10 steps to a fascist state is to control the media. And that's, that hasn't overtly happened. We've still got a pretty open media. You still got a lot of ways to get information. But there's been some things that have happened, if anyone remembers Valerie Plame and what happened with her husband, the article that he wrote and her subsequent ouster as a CIA agent in retaliation for that. You know, I talked to a friend of mine who was ex-military, and he's a pretty ardent Bush supporter, and he had a different take on the whole Valerie Plame issue. That I would have to have him here to go into detail on it, but it was a different viewpoint. And I understand that there's multiple viewpoints, but just the fact that the government would be so comfortable striking out at a media outlet like that, that kind of backhanded, strike back, the fact that we're so comfortable with that is a little worrisome. And another thing that's a little worrisome is the fact that so much of our media is conglomerated into such a small collection of individuals. Clear Channel, Rupert Murdoch, these are the people that hold the media strings. And they're motivated by money. They're not motivated by the intent to deliver good information or a balanced viewpoint on anything. I mean, for Christ's sake, look at Fox News. That's Rupert Murdoch's baby. And that's definitely not a fair and balanced viewpoint. So you've got guys, you've got a small group of individuals that are very corporate, very capitalist, and very, very focused on getting money and earning, making their earnings important. So I wouldn't put it, this is my conjecture, but I wouldn't put it too far past them to bow to government pressure in what they air and what they do with the media, their huge media conglomerates that they control, especially if it's in their best interest from a financial or power point of view. So control the media, I won't say check that one off. But again, like many of the other ones that we haven't exactly checked off, it's pretty quick and pretty close that we can take care of that. Step 9 on the 10 steps is to firm up the concept that dissent equals treason. Now, this is straight out of Military Commissions Act. You know, this goes hand in hand with target key individuals, because you target those key individuals, you make a reason why they are dissenters, therefore they are treasonous, and therefore they need to be detained. And when you've got that terrifying internal and external enemy to invoke, it's pretty easy to get someone to sound treasonous. You know the blackball concept in the 60s and McCarthyism, where if you had any communist, even if you said the word communist, you were culpable to be investigated and not work in this town ever again. So it's not too difficult to put a label on somebody if you want to, especially if the government wants to do it and they have legal measures in which they can actually legally and permanently do so. So dissent equals treason. Well, in Pakistan right now, the military is threatening to shut down any rallies for the opposition to Musharraf. So dissenting Musharraf is treasonous to the Pakistani government, even though the Pakistani government is in limbo right now, because it doesn't really exist, because Musharraf is the Pakistani government right now. So there you go. That's step one. And the fact that Bush is even having conversations with Musharraf is a little disconcerting in my view. You know, step 10 is the coup de grace, and it's the last one, and this is the one that isn't checked and isn't even looking like it's ready to be checked. But the thing about this one is that it doesn't need you don't need groundwork for this last step. Step 10 is to suspend the rule of law. Now, a couple of years ago in conversation, I made a prediction, since I am a prophet of gloom and doom. I made this prediction a couple years ago. In October of 2008, a dirty bomb goes off in Los Angeles, and that's Los Angeles is arbitrary. The only reason I said LA is because it's the second most noteworthy American city, and they've already done enough to New York. So let those guys patch up their wounds and spread a little love to LA. You know, once that happens, George Bush declares martial law. He declares a state of emergency. You know, at that point, we'll be in a war with Iran. The Iranians did it. We'll have more airstrikes. We'll have more military action on the ground. The black vans will roll the streets. Anyone that says anything against what's going on becomes a terrorist. They become an unlawful enemy combatant. They're treasonous. They get rounded up. They get sent to the gulags that we've built in Colorado and Nebraska. The media doesn't show anything other than the side that we want them to see, or that we want that they want us to see, I should say. You know, and the Supreme Court, which is largely the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, installed by Bush. The Supreme Court has already shown their predilection toward the man by basically installing him as president the first time around when we had all that hubbub in Florida that I'm sure none of us forgot. They rubber stamped the whole mess because the Congress has already signed enough concessions to the administration through the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act and other things, the Protect America Act. They're, you know, if and when this happens, the Congress will be both culpable for and powerless to stop anything. You know, they will be powerless to stop the Bush coup. So at that point, we'll be hailing Bush, the Emperor of the Republican States of America under God. And, you know, call me a conspiracy theorist, call me a crackpot, all you want. But you look at the facts, read some things, read some articles, listen to this program a few more times, and then take a hard look at it. And then you might want to revise your statement of me as a crackpot and a theorist and one of the crazies, because that's a pretty easy way for those in power to make sure that dissenting points of view don't get don't get aired, because it's easy to call somebody a crazy. And all those voters in between the coasts, where all those crazies in L.A. and New York, those crazies are out there talking all their nonsense. All those voters that are inland, that make up most of the voting block, they get to go. They get to shake their heads. Well, I'm glad we have such wonderful elected officials to keep me protected from those crazies and the terrorists. And they go hand in hand, those treasonous bastards. You know, if you look at the states that matter in elections, it's not L.A., it's not New York. You know, it's not California. California is a non-entity. California is useless when it comes to elections in our country. You know, next show we're going to talk some more about which states matter in the elections and why they do, and why California is useless, and why the blue states on the coast really don't have a whole lot of say. But we'll get to that in a little bit. We're going to take a break from the Machine Church here on killradio.org. We've just gone through the 10 steps to a fascist America. And some doomsday predictions from a little bit more from the end of the world department. So we're going to take a bit of a break. When we get back, we're going to talk about the Congress for a little bit. And that's going to be it for today's transmission. So hang in there. We will be right back. We are back. Radiohead fades out nicely too. Sometimes they have a little bit of fun with noise at the end of the songs, but we'll allow them a little bit of eccentricity because it is Radiohead after all. All right. Last little bit on the transmission today is going to be a little bit about Congress and about them giving a little bit of a strong hand to Bush on some things. Earlier this year, Congress finished up a bill that was a water resources bill. It's a $23 billion cost on this water resources bill. And it was designed to fund Army Corps of Engineer projects, dams, sewage plants, beach restoration. A lot of it goes includes money for the Gulf Coast and for Florida, the Everglades, to restore the Everglades in the wake of Katrina and all the nonsense that happened over the last couple of years and the extreme weather they've been experiencing. It was passed by the House and the Senate. It was sent to Bush's desk at the end of October. He vetoed it a couple days ago. Went back to the House and the Senate, and they overrode the veto. The Senate voted 79-14, and the House voted 361-54. So in both cases, easily a two-thirds majority needed to override the president's veto. So that bill becomes a law, regardless of whether Bush wants it or not. Now, Bush vetoed it. He's got a big reason for that. There are some reasons for that that I'll talk about in a minute. I've got his statement, his veto message about it. The bill in and of itself is kind of meh. It's kind of not that big of a deal. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of billions in war spending. It's still on the table. You know, the expansion of the Protect America Surveillance Act. You know, things like that that are still kind of up in the air. This water resources bill isn't that big of a deal. You know, detractors talked about how, you know, this is a bill that's supposed to get projects to the Army Corps of Engineers. And they're saying, well, the Army Corps of Engineers has a $58 billion worth of projects in backlog and only about $2 billion worth of annual budget to address them. And fair enough, you know, this bill does have a lot of things in it. It's got a lot of projects. It's got a lot of it's pretty expansive. Maybe slightly overreaching. But the other concern you've got to have is that, you know, this is approving projects and some money for the Army Corps of Engineers. And guess where the Army Corps of Engineers is? I'm sure they've got a few left here in the U.S., but I'll be damned if most of them aren't in the Middle East getting blown up. So it's kind of like when you're a kid and your parents tell you to mow the lawn. And then halfway through mowing the lawn, they yell at you to take the trash out. And when you walk back in from taking the trash out, they bitch at you while you haven't finished mowing the lawn. So the Army Corps of Engineers, yeah, they got a backlog of projects, but were they really in any position in the last 5 or 6 years to actually complete them, given their circumstances? I'd probably say no. I mean, it's an easy position to take to be against, quote unquote, this bill. But the real reason probably boils down to the money. You know, if it was a couple million and it was something that was under the radar, then I'm sure we probably wouldn't have even heard about it. But we're talking about $23 billion. And when Bush wants $200 billion for war spending, you know, that $23 billion could easily be funneled into a program to develop more bombs to drop on Iran. So you've got a bill, gets passed, goes to the president, gets vetoed. And that's happened a couple times in recent memory. Ever since the Democrats took over, they've actually started getting bills to the desk that would need vetoing from the president, and they haven't really had the authority or the majority to muscle them through with a veto override, except for this one. And again, this one's pretty innocuous, so it doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but it does show that Congress has a little bit of muscle left. Whether or not they're using it in the right spots or leveraging it the best way they possibly can remains to be seen. But they managed to leverage plenty of Republicans onto their side for a water spending bill when they couldn't do it for a children's health care bill, which, yeah, beaches are nice and, you know, water is life. But we've all got pretty solid municipal water systems that I'm, as far as I'm aware. And, you know, children's health care, probably a bit more of an issue. Again, that's all been discussed. We've talked about it. And it's a it's beside the point of this this little bit of information, and basically it's just that Congress actually finally got some got pulled up a little bit and sent a strong arm to Bush to muscle a bill into law despite his blocking of it. So, you know, you've got President Bush's his veto message starts off with saying this bill lacks fiscal discipline. And it goes on to talk about how he's fully in support of funding projects that are economically, environmentally viable, blah, 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 blah. It's a lot of nonsense. A lot of numbers and dollar amounts that look fancy on paper but don't really make much statement. You know. He talks about the main mission of the Army Corps Civil Works Program, which is facilitating commercial navigation, reducing the risk of damage from floods and storms, and restoring aquatic ecosystems. And Bush says that this bill does not achieve that goal, even though all the provisos in this bill are about restoring beachfronts, providing money to flood and hurricane-damaged areas, etc., etc. So, building sewage treatment plants to facilitate commercial navigation of treated water back to the ecosystem. So this bill that says it's going to do all these things doesn't do those things. You know, to be honest, I haven't read the bill in its entirety. That's a pretty difficult task these days. So I can't say whether or not it actually would realistically achieve that goal, but the intent of it clearly was. So, we've got the president vetoing it based off of his information. I'm sure it was solid information about how we need to get bombs for Iran. But this is the last little bit of his note that I think is pretty funny. He says, quote, "I urge the Congress to send me a fiscally responsible bill that sets priorities. Americans sent us to Washington to achieve results and be good stewards of their hard-earned taxpayer dollars. This bill violates that fundamental commitment." He goes on to say some other bullshit. But it's just funny that he would mention how American taxpayers sent him to Washington to achieve results and be good stewards of his hard-earned tax dollars. And it is clear now that we don't think the Iraq war is any good stewardship of the money that we are putting into the government and or achieving any solid results, and yet we're still there. So, this is the pot calling the kettle black, or what's good for the goose is good for the gander type of thing. You know, if you're going to veto a little pissant water resources bill on the grounds that it's not fiscally responsible and that it's not achieving solid results, maybe you should fucking look at your goddamn war and how there's no results being achieved there, and it's completely fiscally irresponsible, and revise that prior statement about the little water bill, that could. So that's our president, George W. Bush. Most of you probably hate him already, so I don't need to say anything else to make you hate him more. But nevertheless, it's always fun to pick apart the things that he says, because, you know, it's amazing that we elect someone who doesn't know what words mean. All right, we're about done. I got one last little thing that I mentioned in the previous broadcast, but I didn't get around to go into in any detail. It's just a little tidbit that, I mean, in the one breath, I'm going to say this: Democrats finally got some work done. They got a little bill through. They did a little bit of back talk to the man. But in this next breath, I'm gonna bash them a bit, because the Democrats got in there after they won the majority in Congress last year and talked about how they're going to put Congress back to work and get things moving again. And they're going to be a do-something Congress instead of the do-nothing Congress. That was Harry Reid talking about that. It's 10 months into the session, coming up on 11 months into the session. You know, the legislative agenda of the Congress isn't going anywhere. They're getting bills out. They're trickling bills out to the president that he's subsequently blasting with a double-barrel shotgun and sending beaten back to the Congress to die, you know, unceremoniously in a failed veto override attempt, with the exception of this last one. In light of all that, the democratically controlled Congress is planning a lighter schedule when they reconvene for their second year next year, mid-January. They are saying that the House would not be in session on Fridays, except in June, for work on appropriations bills. And the intent, you know, the stated intent of that is so that the members of the House have the members of the House and Senate, the Congress, have more time for members to work in their districts and to be close to their families. So they get a 3-day weekend every week. When we're talking about a we're talking about perpetual war. We're talking about an economy that can't function and that is you know, paper in comparison to other economies as far as how effective it is would be to ward off any kind of attack. You know, they didn't do anything this year other than bluster and send a few marquee, billboard bills to the president to get some press coverage and then be outraged and have outcry over them getting vetoed. So yeah, they've earned their Fridays off next year. I can see that. I understand that, you know, it's a rough job. You know, I was watching C-SPAN this morning and there was like 7 or 8 guys in there just completely asleep while they talked about all the bills that needed to be voted on for the day. So those guys are working hard out there. And I get it. I'm all for them taking that Friday off, you know, to be with their families and to work in their districts, which they won't. Are you kidding me? You know, I used to work in a trade sales department where I had accounts all over the place here in Southern California. And, you know, every once in a while they'd tell us, hey, we're going to give you guys Friday off and you can take your Friday to cruise out to some of your accounts and, you know, press the flesh, see, you know, talk to them, see their stores, things like that. We never did that. If I got a Friday off for a quote unquote meeting and greeting with my accounts, I slept until noon, got up, made a sandwich, and then sat on the computer all day. So, you know, these congressmen and women that are taking their Fridays off are just going to basically be having a 3-day weekend every week next week or next year, to oversee the last year of the Bush presidency. And, you know, if there's any year that I'd want to be in the Congress and be there every single day to just keep an eye on every single thing that happened, it would be the last year. The last year. You know, Clinton's last year, he did a few hoodwinky type things. He, you know, pardoned a lot of people as his last few actions before he, you know, turned off the, you know, looked back quietly one moment into the office and then turned the light off and credits rolled. You know, he did a lot of things like that, but I'm sure Bush has got some things planned up for if he actually has to leave the office at the end of next year. But you know, assuming that he does, we do have peaceful elections in November, and the new president does get elected that will take power or take over the executive branch, I should say, take power. Oh, so silly. You know, assuming that all does happen, you know, the Congress should be there the whole time, especially a democratically controlled majority Congress should be there to watchdog everything this guy is going to do. I'm talking about the fact that we are so close to military action against Iran that will, you know, embroil us in perpetual war in the Middle East for no reason. We're so close to that it seems to me like we should probably have our Congress present as often as possible, just to keep an eye on things. But that's just me. I've been accused numerous times of actually talking sense in the midst of all of my doomsday ramblings. So you can take that or leave it. But nevertheless, Congress, 4-day work week next year. You know, this is a job. You know, I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't want to become a congressman or become a senator. Because this is a job where when you're scheduled to be there, you don't really have to show up. You know, you have to show up to vote on some important things. And other than that, you don't really have to show up unless you're stupid and you get on a committee and then you're responsible to be there when the committee meets, for Christ's sake. But you don't have to show up. You can send someone to sit there for you. You can, you know, when the House comes to order and you're having a good talk about the game last night with one of your buddies, you know, the Speaker of the House will say, yeah, Congress should come to order, and please take your seat or take your conversations outside. That's great. Whatever happened to please take your goddamn seat and vote on some issues? You know, no, I want to keep talking about the Patriots, so we're going to go hang outside. Oh, what's that? Vote about something? Eh, whatever. You know, it's just, it's nonsense that they get these kind of concessions. And it's like, it's a job where, as of next year, you got a 4-day work week. For a 3-day weekend every week. You don't have to show up the other days if you don't really want to or your party doesn't need you to. And after only 4 years, you get retirement and pension. Just like we talked about with Hillary Clinton, you know, she gets her no matter what happens with the presidential election, even if she quit the Senate at the end of the campaigns next year, she will still get her congressional salary for life. You know, and you know, Bill gets his presidential salary for life, and I'll grant him that. You know, the presidency is a hard job, regardless of how we may trash talk those who are there and bash them for the decisions that they make sometimes. But being the president's a hard job. Look at the picture of Clinton when he got elected, and then look at the picture when he bailed out of office 8 years later. The man got ramshackled. So you know, I'll give Clinton his presidential salary out of my tax dollars for the rest of his life. I'm not too pleased about the fact that if he dies, Hillary gets his salary for the rest of her life in addition to her congressional salary. But you know, I'll allow that. You know, the fact that Hillary's been a congresswoman she's been in the Senate and the House of Representatives, wherever she is. You know, she's been in the Congress for 4 years, and she gets a free check her salary for the rest of her life every year. I'm not too keen on that one, especially when you consider the fact they're talking about a shorter work week for a work week that they don't even that doesn't even have any requirements as it is. All right, we're out. That's it for today. That's the end of today's transmission. We've gone for quite a long time anyway. We've talked about plenty of gloom and doom and plenty of things that are going on. Next week, we're going to go a little bit in depth on the campaign trail and why certain states are more important and why California is completely a complete non-issue and why the Electoral College is an antiquated, outdated system that really doesn't have much bearing left in society, at least in the American electorate. You know, Jimmy Carter runs a international election agency that oversees the fairness, efficacy, truthfulness of elections throughout the world, and issues reports on those elections and how they're complying with standards for electoral processes. And they issued a report recently that the U.S. electoral system no longer complies with any standards of fairness or efficacy because of the whole richest man gets the election concept. And I'll leave you guys to sit on that. That's the end of today's transmission from the Machine Church. You've been listening to killradio.org, and we are out. We'll see you all next week if the world is still around.
And misery. I'm happy fucking first to say it's me. I'm last in line to love myself, it ain't pretty. In fits and dimes I've dabbled in this devilry. Oh Lord, from this evil deliver me. And I'm dragging like a rake at the stale smoke I intake. And I'm slipping to make amends with my family and friends. So deep in debt I might just get the bends. My liver's aching, cause rum and coke numbs a heart that's broke or breaking. It is softest sort of suicide you're making. We're all alone, dry as a bone, forsaken. Or the spit and sweat when it's not there for the taking. And I'm dragging like a rake to find who's real and who is fake. Could you keep up for fuck's sake? Follow the broken promises in my wake. To no one but me, these promises did I make. And I'm no one's advocate, but yours, my love. I'm waiting outside a new baseball park to come and pick me up. The fall line changes, pissing rain, and I haven't seen one buzz. I have a sneaky feeling I'm missing something. Well, that's just me, and it's probably us. Take this lid off less cowardly. For a discount diamond ring and marriage licensing. For everything you've done and what you bring. Picture the daughter and the love in your delivery.